Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Greetings. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Matthew Felling of Channel 11 News. Bruce Wyrock, a former Juneau House member, cuts a deal with the federal government, federal prosecutors, over his indictment for campaign corruption, for political corruption. Paul, take us through the thicket that leads to the conclusion of this case, if we have a conclusion.
I don't know that we have a conclusion. The corruption investigations back in 2006, 2007 snared him. He was on tape asking for legal work from Vico Corporation, Bill Allen, Rick Smith. And the feds initially indicted him on bribery, extortion, fraud, and conspiracy. Four very serious federal felonies, 5-year sentences for each if they wanted to do it that way. And they proceeded. The government proceeded under an honest services fraud doctrine, which means that he was depriving the citizens of Alaska of honest representation while he was doing that. At some point, as these cases one by one start to fall apart, I think they lost their zeal to prosecute him. This case went through the U.S. District Court here. It went through appeals court and wound up with the Supreme Court.
The appeal was of the process.
Exactly. Yeah. And the honest services fraud went out the window with the Supreme Court. So now they're left with not very much. They agreed to allow him to plead to a misdemeanor state charge, basically of consorting with people that he knew should have been registered as lobbyists. That would have been Allen and Smith. $1,000 fine, I think, a suspended sentence, that sort of thing. Wasn't much. And in return,
he'll be allowed to practice law.
And that, I think you realize probably the Bar Association will decide that one way or the other. At least he has the chance to. And at this point, he's home free.
Steve, your assessment of this case, which has gone on so long.
It has gone on for a long time, and it kind of ends on a whimper, I guess a good thing for former Representative Wyrock. But he was going through his legal rights and the legal process, and I think one of the advantages that happened for him during this whole process was the fact that the case against Senator Stevens was virtually thrown out. Came to light that there was prosecutorial misconduct, same issues in the Wyrock case. So I think that just added a lot of weight to what the judges decided to do here with the Wyrock case. This case that we thought was going to ensnare or had the potential to ensnare so many former lawmakers, present lawmakers, now we've just seen the whole thing unravel, and this is the latest step in that unraveling.
It's very interesting because there would have been pressure at the early on in the case for him to settle, him to come to an agreement with the federal government. That's quite clear that he made the right decision not doing that.
Right, and I'm sure what happened in the Stevens case, again, there was thousands of documents. There were thousands of documents that the former prosecutors in the case, neglected to share with the Stevens defense, and it just underscored what the Wyrock side was going through here, and it's probably a punishment that fits the crime at this particular point.
Matthew, want to add something here?
Well, there's a lot of bad news. Something's rotten in Norway. Something stinks to high hell. The legal profession, the prosecutors, the affairs of state. But it's a boom time for cynicism in Alaska. I mean, everybody can find something to be irritated about with this decision. We have a case where a guy basically milked the clock. Prosecutors hid the ball, and we have a case where you watched it in a reverse auction. They had these charges, they lowered them, they bid against themselves, and then it was finally it ended up being a misdemeanor and $1,000, which in this case ends up as the equivalent of a speeding ticket. And I'd like to know we always talk about the Miranda law when it comes to, reading them the rights. But I think with this investigation, now with the decision and the real definition is going to be the Mendoza line. I mean, are they going to even bat 200 when it comes to getting any punishments at all, that, with any teeth at least?
And one of the things that happened here is the prosecutors changed. There was a new group of prosecutors involved here close to the end. Doug Pope who's a well-known attorney and old friend of mine from Fairbanks, has been involved in this from the beginning with Wyrock. And that might not give you an advantage in the law when you're up against the federal government, but it may give you some practical advantage in dealing with all these new people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the case can be made that they did not choose to be removed from their investigation proceedings.
I think that's a fact. All right. Former Representative Vic Coring appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court, and the Ninth Circuit upheld his appeal. We had some of that last week as the story broke right as we went on air. Steve, now that we've had a chance to digest the case and mm-hmm. take a look at the ruling, the three judges were pretty unsparing in what they had to say about the prosecutors.
Yeah, they were pretty blunt. The vote was 2-1. Two judges said, okay, we got to give him a new trial. So obviously, again, the prosecution messed up enough to the point where we got to give him a new trial, right? And one of the judges said, just let this guy go. There was so much wrong, so many things wrong with the prosecution's case against Coring that let the guy go free. He's gone through enough. You guys really messed this up.
May I just add a little spice
to
what you said? I can't resist. She called the government's conduct flagrant and unrepentant.
Yes.
And several friends of mine pointed out to me that the term unrepentant is unusual in this context. It's usually reserved for sentencing of convicted criminals.
Yeah, that's true, too. And I think the word egregious also wound up in one of those comments that she made as well. You're right. It was just unsparing. It was a very blunt decision and a very blunt assessment of what the prosecution did in this case against Coring. And so we'll see. Maybe there won't be another trial. Maybe the prosecution just says, okay, we've had enough. He's been through enough. Let's just cut this whole sorry episode loose and go on. Something back what Matthew was saying a little bit, too, is I think what's so frustrating for people is we saw all this videotape from that hotel room, you know? There's all this videotape, and there's obviously something
the quality
amiss.
Might not have been as good as Channel 2 or Channel 11.
Yeah, it wasn't in HD, but it was enough to see and hear what was going on. And obviously, there's something amiss when it came to Mr. Smith and Mr. Allen and Mr. Coring and things being exchanged and things being said. So, you know, and then to have this thrown back at the prosecution, they really messed up and did things
Matthew.
Like the judge says.
Well, yeah, bloviation all aside, I don't think we're going to see a retrial here. I think everybody's just tired of this, and nobody wants to go through the motions again. And it would just be picking at a scab that nobody wants to deal with. And we're living in a mediated age, where we watch sporting events, and you know, if there's a baseball game, we say we need instant replay on that. We think that everything can be cured, and all of our problems can be cured because if we just have the video, everything will be all right. We had the video, we had the audio, we all heard it, and the fact that these things could not be punished to the full extent of the law just adds to the cynicism and adds to the people's suspicion of what was happening behind the scenes.
The judges in this case made the point that even though Judge Sedgwick had placed a lot of emphasis here in Alaska on the videotapes, that it was unclear what exactly was changing mm-hmm. hands. And I found it was remarkable once they got into the records that the government had kept of testimony or interviews with Smith mm-hmm. and Mr. Allen, that there was wide disagreement on how much money had changed hands and what the motives were and how often it changed hands. And it seemed like a couple points. I'm not going to take up any more of your time, but one more thing. I'm a sinner here, but you'll forgive me, I hope, is
weren't handing out prayer cards.
No, that's true.
Are we fair? Or granola bars. They were actually handing out some amount of
money.
But
what the government seemed to do is Smith on one occasion said it was $100, and he said it was $500, and Allen said it was $1,000. So the government's solution was just round it up to the highest number.
So it's Winston Churchill's famous adage, what we're doing right now is just niggling over price. Is it 100, is it 500, is it 100?
Yeah, and there's been that. Mm-hmm. And also, though, motive, because there was some indication that Mr. Allen gave the money out of pity or friendship, which mm-hmm. confused the matter.
Which factor in one more thing here, too, is all the information that's come to light since the Stevens trial, And that further damages the credibility of Bill Allen. And that was the investigation that was conducted by APD, the Anchorage Police Department, into allegations that he was engaging in sexual activity with young women, all that. So, you know, you've got all of that questionable behavior and added into people not being able to agree on what the facts were in the original cases. So that will probably weigh in to the decision of whether or not to retry Coring.
No, that's right. And Paul, inquiring minds want to know, and are we ever going to know, what went wrong with the prosecution?
At this point, we have prosecutors removed from these cases. We have prosecutors castigated from the bench by federal judges. We have a prosecutor who committed suicide. The mess is so nasty that I doubt seriously we ever will find out. The thing that gets me at the federal level, and you start talking about federal officials at a high level, as prosecutors are, if they're fired immediately, the crime was pretty minor. If they're not fired at all, it was huge. These people haven't been fired. And the same thing, we need to find out what it is. It cost us a U.S. senator in this state. It's cost the state being the laughing stock of the nation. People don't really know now that these cases have tanked. They only know that Alaska is corrupt. And to me, I mean, that launched people's political careers. It ended people's political careers.
And we need to find, exactly.
Yeah. And we need to find out, and I don't know how we will, the press in the state will have to do it, find out exactly what happened. It will be an unforgiving and probably impossible task.
Okay, thank you. Matthew, you've been covering the latest debate and the latest development over ACES, the Palin tax regimen in Juneau. What did you find out, and what can you tell us?
Yeah, well, today's New York Times. Sorry, apologies. We are taping this on a Friday. Sorry that I had to open up the curtain. ACES is facing the retraction of a portion of ACES, the tax structure on our oil production, is facing a tough crowd down in Juneau. I mean, Parnell has some serious believers along with him that say that, listen, the state's tax structure, our business environment is just way too unfriendly to the oil producers, and we're all afraid and timorous because of what's happening in North Dakota and Wyoming. They have lower tax rates, and they're getting a lot of money, a lot of jobs, and they're making that case, and they're pounding away at it day after day after day. Then we see it's that issue of you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. Everybody's tossing facts and numbers out on a day-to-day basis. We have this many percentage of oil companies who are against doing business here. We have this many people. We have CNBC saying that we're number two in terms of business-friendly environment. The only thing that is against us is roads, distance, and climate. It's not our tax structure.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln.
Precisely. But no, I've been talking to some legislators behind the scenes. They know that there is merit. They want to sort of split the baby halfways. They want to find some sort of a compromise, which parenthetically might have been what Parnell was looking for afterward, after everything is said and done. But this is going to go into the ninth inning. Let's hope it's not going to be extra innings with a special session. But it's got a tough crowd. Even some senators on the governor's
Republican
own side,
yeah.
Wagner is not convinced whatsoever.
Of the Kenai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. So it's
Paul,
you
want to chime in here?
It is going to have a tough time in the Senate. I don't know that they'll get it done this session. They do need more information. They basically can't tell you where it stands right now. They don't know how much the tax has taken in, where it's gone, what they've done with it. They don't have a clue. But what we do know is throughput in the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline is dropping at 7% a year. Jobs are down, investments down. We know that's happening. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it, we don't know. The only thing that really needs to be fixed in ACES right now is the stair-stepping progressivity in the law, which is what the oil companies are so upset about.
Not to turn this into like point counterpoint, I mean, one of the problems, of course, is the fact that we don't know what will happen if we do pull back on ACES. Even the oil companies are being honest enough saying, if you do this, we're going to give it the college try, but we don't want to be committed. We don't want you to give us things to pin down and make any promises. We're not 100% sure.
The problem you have is the critics will say, well, it's going to cost the state $2 billion a year. Mm-hmm. The other way to look at that is you're taking $2 billion a year too much. And I think that's what the oil industry will tell you. There's got to be somewhere in the middle, mm-hmm. And that's why they need the more information. Whether they'll get it or not, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to Steve McDonald. The trail was cold in places, but the Iditarod ended in a heartwarming story when John Baker won.
Yeah, it was
tell
a good
us about
story.
John Baker, and tell us about the challenges facing television when it covers a very long,
long
dog sled
spread
race.
Spread out, remote. Yeah. Well, first part, John Baker, he's run the race 15, 16 times. First time he's won it from Kotzebue. So it's kind of almost a hometown boy that won this thing. Good guy, man of few words, ran a great race, sets another record. Just when you think that race just can't get any faster, and he does this. So he ran a great race, and the folks up in the region there are very, very proud of him, as they should be. He's a very good musher, and he's been around the top echelon of mushers for a while. So this was the logical next step for him to win it. As for covering this thing, yeah, it's a logistical nightmare in a lot of ways, and obviously we cover it the same way with as other people following the Iditarod on the trail, you know, airplanes, and we hire out two airplanes. We have a crew, a reporting crew in one. We've got a reporting crew in another, and our portable satellite gear that weighs about 1,800 pounds. So that goes from village to village, and it's just a lot of hopping around trying to capture a story in one village, fly to where the our NORSAT, our portable satellite gear, set up, and doing the story there, editing and shooting. And then you keep your fingers crossed and the prayer beads handy, and you hope the weather doesn't flare up like it did last year for us. Mm-hmm. That's where that second crew comes into play, so we at least have something on the air that night. And I think the people want to see what's going on the trail. They want to hear from the mushers, and that's really important. And then the other thing is just keeping everybody abreast of where the mushers are and where the standings are. So yeah.
And generally speaking, it's better to end for television at 11 in the morning or 10 than five in the morning.
The last couple of years, it's been pretty good time. Of course, we always would love to have it at about 6:05 in the evening. That would be really perfect.
Not all of us, Steve McDonald. Yeah, not all of us.
But I can remember him going off like 2:00, mm-hmm. ending at 2:30, whatever it was, 3:00, which was great for the party in Nome. But now all of a sudden it's like the last couple of years it's been mid-morning. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of nice. It's easy on our crew too.
How dare they not craft a major sporting event in the state without taking TV into account? 39 years ago, where was the vision?
Yeah.
Where was the foresight?
We control everything, I thought.
No, but Baker's fantastic.
Well, you could enforce TV timeouts on
the
mushers. Yeah,
so
you could try that.
Well, we do have GPS, and it is fantastic. Baker is sort of the Charles Barkley of Iditarod racing. Even when they stopped him at the very end and said, "Do you want to be an inspiration to all of your Alaska natives who are banging the drums and dancing for you?" And he's like, "I don't want to be an inspiration. I just want them to follow whatever they're going to do. I'm not a role model. They don't have to do what I'm doing. I just want them to be the best at what they're doing."
Well, the GPS story I liked is one of the mushers gave his GPS to a pilot, and therefore it showed that this musher had traveled 80 miles in an hour.
Yeah.
But in any case, the census is out, and we have discovered, Paul, what parts of Alaska have gained population, and probably significantly and surprisingly, what parts have lost. And this is really important for a number of reasons. Federal funding is one, but another is the apportionment of the Alaska legislature.
State population has grown something like 83,000 since 2000. Excuse me, a third of that was in Mat-Su. The Mat-Su borough has picked up a wad of people out there. Alaska's gone from 627,000 to 710,000. Anchorage itself has gone from 260 to 291,000. Rural Alaska, Southeast Alaska, are the losers of population. And urban areas, road, rail belt has picked up.
And I think part of the explanation there is economics.
Economics. That's where the jobs are. People go where the jobs are, and they're coming here. And what that's going to mean is it's 17,756 is the ideal equal apportionment across all the districts. For house districts. And what this means is that they're likely to lose some representation in southeastern rural Alaska and will gain it in the more urban areas.
Matthew, what do you know? You've been working on this story and the apportionment story, and there appears that there's partisanship.
Oh, shocked. Shocked that there's gambling going on at Rick's. Well, I mean, it's not news to the people at this table, but it's one of those things that's an underlying issue that not enough people, the people that I came across in my story that were just man on the streets, they didn't understand. They just thought, oh, well, we have a district. We must just draw a box next to a box next to a box in a way that makes sense. And I sit down with the guy who ran the redistricting program back in 2000, Gordon Harrison. He's written a 17-page legal essay saying—
He's an academic, yeah.
Yeah, well, so thusly—
I know him. I wasn't demeaning him.
Academic. Yeah, ivory tower. No, but he's written an article saying that there is no way in this, the way that this structure is written up, that it's not going to be partisan, because we have these five people who are appointed by governor, by the Senate. And having a Republican in all those places guarantees that it's going to be a partisan process. The story this election cycle is going to be whether or not the people come out and say, listen, we want to see how you guys draw these lines. We have some suggestions. If they don't get involved, and it's not a right-left issue, it's just the fact that this is smacks of partisanship.
One of the things that people in the minority can do is they can put together a team and lawyers and other skilled people and present the board mm-hmm. with a plan through testimony and craft a plan that's favorable to incumbents. That's something incumbents always like, regardless of what party, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there are people that I spoke to in the story that are not on the record and said, don't you dare quote me on this. But I mean, the people admit that they definitely influence their own district size and they draw it. But it's a very non-democratic
and the
ideal.
Most partisan thing of all, I mean, from the idea of electing members of your own party is to put two members of the opposite party in the same district.
Mm-hmm.
And this has happened before.
Oh, they forced out three into one. And I sat down with the guy who's running it this year, who's a former Republican legislator, and I said, how do you face these issues? How do you face the questions of bias, given the fact that you're your assistant right here to my side, playing on his BlackBerry?
Don't tease us. What did Senator Torgerson say?
Oh, he said, well, that's just the nature of the beast. And I mean, the guy who was assigned, who was working on his press, worked for the Alaska Victory Tour in 2010. I mean, there is nothing in this process that seems to be apolitical. Then again, should it be? Could it ever be? No.
Well, there's some states that California, for one, have attempted to get away from. I mean, at one point, Congressman Phil Burton drew the whole state. I mean, he was a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, they have a different system, but here we could have legislators themselves writing it, right? We have a modified partisan.
Yeah, which was Gordon Harrison's solution, which is still not a very perfect way of going about it either.
We kind of tiptoe around the partisan, nonpartisan thing around here regarding the redistricting. In Ohio, Ohio's controlled by Republicans right now. One of the most outspoken and popular Democrats is Dennis Kucinich, right? Presidential candidate, but he's a congressman from outside the Cleveland area, and he's been a congressman for quite a few years. The Republican Party, when it got the census report, said right out, they said, we're going to redistrict Kucinich's district right out of existence. They didn't pull any punches. He's gone, you know. So he's going to have to probably run against another Democrat if he's going to want to retain his seat or his old seat. But no bones about it back there. Yeah, we're going to redistrict, and he's gone. He's out of here.
That plays out with a big spotlight on the federal level, but here on the state level, it has high stakes, and it's a little bit less covered, a little bit less formalized.
Yeah, but we also should point out too. I think Governor Knowles was in office when the census rolled around one time, and the same charges were made against the
Absolutely.
Democrats. So it's just like whoever's in power
and it just flips overnight.
Quickly, this is the political earthquake we've just dealt with. Now the real earthquake in Japan and the aftermath. Steve, what might be the consequences for Alaska, a major trading partner of Japan?
Obviously there's a disruption of it right now in the short term. Long term, you know, you just pray and hope that the folks in Japan, and I'm sure they will, they'll get back on their feet and get back to normal as soon as they possibly can after this devastating event. But they're our number one trading partner. And obviously the fishing industry
right.
up here depends on them greatly. So they're probably, I think in the long run, things will eventually get back to normal. Short term, though, it may be pretty bumpy.
Okay, we need to hustle. We have too many topics, but not enough time. Paul and Fairbanks, a group of self-styled militia men and tax protesters, got arrested, and they're in a whole lot of trouble with the federal government under a multiple number of charges, including threatening to murder a federal judge and his wife. What happened, and if it's true that they obtained all this weaponry, high-caliber weaponry and even hand grenades, how could they do it?
Well, obtaining the weapons is not that difficult. Cash talks. If you've got the money, you can buy anything you want. Up to missiles and rocket launchers or anything else. You can make silencers at home. You can make your weapons automatic at home. It's not that hard to do. We have an entire federal agency that spends its time running around trying to gather these things back up. Military, they're stolen from the military, stolen from the police, stolen from the FBI. The FBI lost a big van full of these things a couple of years ago. So it's not hard to get those. And what these people were doing, they were wrapped up in a tax case. They decided that, by golly, that the federal government was out to get them. They went after the federal judge. They went after Alaska State Troopers.
They talked about doing
it. They talked about it.
Okay. And that's probably going to be some of the
Yeah, that's
events.
Probably as far as
Let's get Matt Felling in here because we are going to run out of time. Matthew, Mayor Dan Sullivan wants to spend some money to save money. He's going to bring in some efficiency experts.
Yeah, I mean, last year he had a website where he said, give me some ideas of how we can cut some corners, cut some waste out of it. He got the low-hanging fruit, and this week he announced that he's going to take requests for proposals from consultants. The question is going to be some assembly required in the story. Does the money amount saved equal the bringing in of consultants? And that's going to be something we're going to have to follow for the next year.
And finally,
so.
Briefly, Attorney General John Burns faced a grilling from legislators on healthcare costs.
The fact that we have turned down the healthcare money has not gone.
In this case, I think it's about $1 million.
$1 million to set up a healthcare exchange in this state. And Mr. Burns, our new AG, is basically trying to stick to his guns and say, listen, I abide by this ruling in Florida. Darn the torpedoes with the other rulings, and he got a lot of consternation in Juneau.
Well, even given what the judge in Florida said, that he was going to abide by the national
precisely
the bill. Okay, thank you very much for joining us here on Anchorage Edition. We'll see you in 2 weeks. I'll be in Fairbanks next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.